The Sunstone Foundation presents Music in the Mormon Culture, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 27th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the St. Mark's Cathedral, where the program is about to begin.
I was told that I should stand between or behind the bars. They wired me for sound, and then I had to go to the restroom. I hope I didn't disturb anybody. I also hope that you can hear me all right in the back. Can you, Petersons? I have... It is. I recognize a lot of my former colleagues. This is the first time that they have ever had to listen to a been subjected to having to listen to me give an extended speech. This speech was intended to be a continuation of the discussions that we have enjoyed the last few days in the Sunstone Symposium. I was asked if I could do something to bring the element of music together with the theological discussions that have been going on. I've decided to call this an aesthetic approach to divine revelation, or vice versa. Divine revelation is the core of all that we've done in the name of Sunstone this past week. Latter-day Saints believe it to be the rock upon which their church is built. The term has two distinct meanings in Mormon usage. One is the process of communication between God and humanity. And the other is the actual content of those communications in their various forms. While there are aspects in which LDS revelation may be considered unique, the principle that God has enlightened mankind with messages given through special emissaries is common to all of the world's major religions. I consider these observations tonight to be valid in application to all revealed religions, not just to Mormonism. I hasten to add that what I have to say comes entirely from my own experience, and like the hundreds of other messages we've heard during this theological orgy, does not necessarily represent the opinions of our sponsors. Most of all, I hope that nothing that I say will detract in any way from your enjoyment of the beautiful gift of music, which is our primary reason for being here. I admire the equanimity as well as the ecumenity of spirit characteristic of the attitudes of most people toward music. Almost everyone has his or her favorites, often held with some passion, yet there is a noticeable tolerance among most people toward those who's with other preferences when compared with the gulfs which separate people according to their religious preferences. Religious differences continue to be a major cause of war, even in this century, which is supposed to be an irreligious century. Tastes in music may range as far afield as John Cage, Guillaume de Machaut, U2, without incurring anything like wrath, ostracism, or condemnation, with two exceptions which come to mind, though they seldom reach the violent stage. Parents concerned about the influence of certain styles of music on their children being one exception, and the other being certain academics who have not yet severed the ties that bind them to their mentors. The latter can be identified by a subtle rolling of the eyes back into the head when the name Tchaikovsky is mentioned. But generally, personal tastes in music are indulged with good nature. One almost yearns for the good old days when a premiere might cause a riot. I doubt that St. Mark's Cathedral has anything to fear from tonight's performance unless through offense from the spoken word. That there may be some degree of otherworldly inspiration involved in the creation of music is almost taken for granted, even by otherwise skeptical scholars. In fact, composers themselves contribute to the mystique surrounding the creative process, probably as an admission that they are actually involved in something otherworldly without having to openly admit it. But I've never heard the notion articulated that the ultimate worth of a piece might depend on its revelatory origin. The following is excerpted from a transcript of a conversation recorded in the home of Johannes Brahms in 1896, about 6 months before the composer's death. The complete text may be found in a book entitled Talks with Great Composers by Arthur M. Abel. Mr. Abel participated in this conversation along with Joseph Joachim, the celebrated violinist and close personal friend to whom Brahms dedicated the violin concerto. A bilingual stenographer was engaged by Mr. Abel through the American Embassy in Vienna to record the evening's conversation. Brahms began by referring to an incident related to him by a violinist he had known named Grünberg, who had played in Beethoven's orchestra. He reported that during the first rehearsal of a new composition by Beethoven, Schuppansiek, the concertmaster, complained to Beethoven that a certain passage was so badly written as to be unplayable for the left hand. Whereupon Beethoven shrieked at him, "Do you think I consider your puny little fiddle when God speaks to me?" Brahms also referred to a statement Beethoven made to Bettina von Arnim in 1810, quote, "I know that God is nearer to me than to others of my craft. I consort with him without fear," end of quote. This was cited by Ernest Newman, one of England's great musicologists, in the Atlantic Monthly of March 1953. Brahms then went on to describe his own experience in contacting deity, and the rest of this is a rather long quote. "To realize that we are one with the Creator, as Beethoven did, is a wonderful and awe-inspiring experience. I always contemplate this before beginning to compose. When I feel the urge, I begin by appealing directly to my Maker, and I first ask Him the three most important questions pertaining to our life here in this world. Woher, warum, wohin? Where did I come from? Why am I here? And where am I going? I immediately feel vibrations that thrill my whole being. These are the Spirit, illuminating the soul power within. And in this exalted state, I see clearly what is obscure in my ordinary moods. Then I feel capable of drawing inspiration from above as Beethoven did. Above all, I realize at such moments the tremendous significance of Jesus' supreme revelation, I and my Father are one. Those vibrations assume the forms of distinct mental images after I have formulated my desire and resolve in regard to what I want, namely to be inspired so that I can compose something that will uplift and benefit humanity, something of permanent value. Straightway, the ideas flow in upon me directly from God. And not only do I see distinct themes in my mind's eye, but they are clothed in the right forms, harmony, and orchestration. Measure by measure, the finished product is revealed to me when I'm in those rare, exalted moods. I have to be in a semi-trance to get such results, a condition when the conscious mind is in temporary abeyance and the subconscious is in control. For it is through the subconscious mind which is part of omnipotence, that the inspiration comes. I have to be careful, however, not to lose consciousness. Otherwise, the ideas fade away. Brahms continues, that is the way Mozart composed. He was once asked what the process was with him while composing, and he replied, es geht bei mir zu wie in einem schönen, starken Traume. The process with me is like a vivid dream. He then went on and described how ideas clothed in the proper musical setting streamed down upon him, just as they do with me. Of course, a composer must have mastered the technique of composition. Form, theory, harmony, counterpart, instrumentation. But any musical person can do that if he has proper application. Spirit is the light of the soul. Spirit is universal. Spirit is the creative energy of the cosmos. The soul of man is not conscious of its powers until it is enlightened by spirit. All great creative geniuses do this, although some of them do not seem to be as conscious of the process as others. Brahms then cited St. John chapter 14, verse 10, the Father that dwelleth in me, he doeth the works. And then verse 12, he that believeth me, the works that I do, shall he do also, and greater works than these shall he do. Mr. Abel provides us with over 150 pages of such startling testimony involving several other equally famous turn-of-the-century composers. This brings us to some questions I wish to pose for your consideration. I assume most of us here are familiar with the works of Brahms and the other composers whom he mentioned. What difference does their claim to divine intervention make to us, who already have formed an opinion about their music? Is there a sense in which their works are enhanced by that claim? Does it impose an obligation on us as listeners to Mozart, Beethoven, and Brahms? Does that obligation include liking them, listening to them on a regular basis, learning to perform their works? What did they experience which caused them to think God was influencing them? Are we under an obligation to pray for a personal revelation confirming the authenticity of their claims? In what form might we expect that confirmation to come? If we receive a divine confirmation, are we obliged to testify to others and evangelize amongst those who have not yet received a conviction of the divinity in those compositions? What other criteria or procedures can be used to determine the authenticity of their claims? Should what we know of the composer's personal life style affect our acceptance of their work as the product of divine revelation? In other words, is there a link between the composer's personal worthiness and having God as a co-creator? How can we distinguish the works or portions of them dictated by the Spirit from those in which the composers were left to their own devices? Should there be an institution established to ensure the perpetuation of their music and to provide authentic interpretations thereof? What do such claims imply about music which does not make such claims? What was God's intention in giving to some composers and withholding from others? Or how might our own righteousness or lack of it influence our musical preferences? Is God involved if a listener prefers Salieri to Mozart or Ravel to Brahms? What role is divinely sanctioned music intended to play in our lives? Music without the divine stamp. Will listening to inspired music bring us closer to God? Is some of it essential to salvation? What if we miss hearing the divinely appointed works as a result of being in the wrong time or place, not having had them amply presented to us? Will we get a chance to hear them in the hereafter? Is just sitting through a performance enough? Must we be moved by it? Should we all take music appreciation, therefore? European orchestral music or the music of Southeast Asia? What about the music of India, Africa, or of Native Americans? Which century? Is older or older music more authentic or more likely to have been God-inspired? Is the same process of revelation influencing composers writing today? 12-tone composers, minimalists, rock and roll, New Age. Are some styles acceptable to God and others not? Is lack of inspiration a failure to ask, a failure of faith, of technique, or just moral turpitude? What if the music has words? The magic flute, the Missa Solemnis, or the German Requiem. Do similar criteria maintain for verbal and nonverbal revelation? Should the words be submitted for correlation to assure they are logically and theologically sound? Can the music be of a higher sphere while the words remain worldly? Or vice versa. What qualities do words possess which suit them to be the language of God in some sense that nonverbal communication may not be? Which is the more reliable earmark of divine revelation, truth or beauty? Is the category of truth relevant to a musical work? To what extent is beauty a sign of God's participation in verbal communication? Is God's influence to be found primarily in the form or the content? I'm sure you're tired of questions by now. They could be multiplied, however, probably until the 1990 symposium. I believe their irrelevance within the context in which we normally think of music to be obvious. So any continuation of the list would indeed be superfluous. What I hope to suggest at this point is that our attitudes toward music, which make these questions appear irrelevant, might be carried over into the domain of religious experience, where we would find them equally irrelevant. The LDS concept of revelation comes with assumptions loaded with dilemmas for the person wishing to deal with it on a practical level. In the interest of time, I'll mention three. That the receiver is aware of the process when he or she experiences it and can distinguish its content from knowledge obtained through other processes, such as experience, observation, verbal or written transmission from other humans, and so on. Number two, that knowledge obtained through revelation is more pure or more true than that obtained through other means. And three, that the content of revelation has a special urgency, if not essentiality, relating to the welfare of human beings, or to put it in the religious vernacular, may be essential to salvation. It is my personal conviction that the implied superiority of revelation over other forms of knowledge cannot be maintained without the risk of exercising unrighteous dominion. There is no scarcity of claimants to divine influence in every phase of life, including hundreds of books, which, like the Book of Mormon, comes with a claim to divine origin. The claimants to divine revelation run a gamut from the pathologically insane to prophets, artists, athletes, even businessmen. In addition to those who claim revelation for themselves, there are abundant instances of individuals possessing extraordinary powers or knowledge without making any specific claim to divine revelation, for which the explanation popularly given is divine gift. Mormons are especially inclined toward that posture, not only because of their belief in spiritual gifts, but especially because the Book of Mormon's divine origin is thought to be substantiated by there being no alternative logical explanation for its origin. Often there is no correlation between the quality of the object produced and a claim to divine revelation. It's commonplace for LDS professional musicians to receive copies of musical compositions accompanied by the claim that they were received through a supernatural agency with an accompanying mandate for wide dissemination, with absolutely no apparent artistic merit. The agency is variously described as Holy Spirit, etc. One may hear testimonials in almost any sacrament meeting attesting to extraordinary revelatory experience via these same agencies. Seldom is there any attempt to distinguish what agency might be involved, and the question of verification seldom arises. In the cases of inferior musical works, one is confronted with the alternative that God's influence is granted without reference to competence, or at least that there is no correspondence between God's standards of excellence and those of humankind. Substantial difficulties arise out of the sheer number of claimants to divine origin. The typical presentation of the restoration of the gospel stresses the uniqueness of Joseph Smith's revelatory experience. But there is, without mention of the ubiquity of similar experiences in the literature of his time and ours, the questions start all over again. What is our obligation toward the other claimants? Is our obligation different toward some than others? Which ones? Some even include the same test articulated in Moroni chapter 10, verse 3. Most of you know what that test is. I will quote such a passage from chapter 9, verse 8 to 10, in the Book of Inspiration in a new Bible. Not the Judeo-Christian Bible, but a volume called OASP. I have given thee many sacred books, and I said to thee, save thou judgest them, thou shalt be caught in a snare. I charge thee that thou shalt accept nothing from men or angels nor gods, but thou shalt rely on thine own inspiration from thy Creator. The words have a familiar ring to Latter-day Saints. I once asked the bishop of a university ward who had related to me how he obtained a testimony of the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon if he had any sense of obligation toward other books which made the same claim. His answer was that he didn't want to question God on the matter when he had already received an answer that covered all the bases. Since it is physically not possible to read all of those books with a sincere heart, with real intent, and so on, we are left with such alternatives as the luck of the Irish, first come, first served, or God as a respecter of persons. I would like to finish on a more positive note by returning to the proposition that our attitude toward God's role in the creative process, as related by Brahms, might be extended into the theological domain and examine what implications that might have for Latter-day Saints facing some of the dilemmas suggested by these questions. The attitude which enables us to maintain our equanimity in the face of the variety of choices available to us in music is that we consider our choice of music to be an aesthetic one. That is, relating more to our attraction to beauty than our conviction that we have found the truth. If it is possible to establish some connection or equivalency between truth and beauty, then it follows that we can afford to be more tolerant toward religious choice. Granted that for the majority, religion is not a matter of choice, but geographical accident. I am speaking about those who indeed make mature religious choices, whether by the selection of a new religion or by the serious investigation and conversion to the religion of their parents. The words of Keats from Ode to On a Grecian Urn have an axiomatic ring as they sum up what we seem to know intuitively. Beauty is truth, truth beauty. That is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know. While the seriousness of choosing a religion compels us to consider fully all the saving, logical, theological, sociological, humanitarian cost-benefit implications, I believe the aesthetic factor may prevail over all other considerations in cases where mature individuals choose their religion freely and intelligently. I ask you to indulge me in a simplistic definition of aesthetics as pertaining to the sense of the beautiful. I am proposing that our religious choices are often dependent on the ability of a religious institution's style and theology to mesh with our aesthetic sensibilities. Alma's Discourse on Faith includes a reference to the beginning of faith and the necessity for the believer to exercise a particle of faith. Quote, "Yea, even if ye can no more than desire to believe, let this desire work in you until ye believe in a manner that ye can give place for a portion of my words." Alma chapter 32, verse 27. Desiring to believe in that context is no more nor less than the notion of aesthetic attraction. Indeed, the beginning of faith. Often we may not know what factors influence our attraction to one thing or another. Take the selection of a life companion, for instance. While preferences for red hair, long hair, the lean look, etc. may be influenced by culture or commerce, ultimately the reasons why an individual may be attracted to one person as opposed to another remains a mystery. I myself do not know why bananas are one of my favorite food while my daughter gags at the sight of one. But I believe that those deep feelings which attract us to a particular piece of music may also explain why aspects of our religion attract or repel us. And it follows that if religion is largely an aesthetic choice, rather than a search for the one true one, that not only will the process of the search be altered, but how we live that choice will be altered as well. Such a search begins with the recognition that deep in our hearts we are drawn toward the eternal, as manifest in that which appears to be beautiful to us. That attraction is without expectation of reward and is best described as love. It follows that the ability to recognize beauty, then, is among the most desirable of all gifts. The artist's profession is to follow that attraction. Is not good beauty manifest in action? Is not truth beauty manifest in words? I believe the seed Alma speaks of, which underlies and precedes belief in people or propositions, is the magnetic attraction, a magnetic attraction of the beautiful. If one's religion of choice is one which sympathetically vibrates to his or her heart, loyalty and dedication become moot issues. One is simply there, where the seed within one's heart can grow in the company of others who have made similar choices. I relinquish the argument. We are here tonight to celebrate beauty, as manifest in sounds created in the imagination of Bill Call. We celebrate the grace that has such power we sometimes call it scripture. or the voice of God. We celebrate the human voice, cultivated and tempered to transform everyday utterance into the sound of angels. We celebrate paper and writing and printing and computers, which make possible the performance of this music 1,000 years from tonight. We celebrate this space, created and consecrated for the highest thought of which we are capable. We celebrate coming together and feeling one with another, our commonalities and our differences. We celebrate the unselfish love of those who have worked tirelessly and taken risks in preparing this event, for whom the only thanks is our enjoyment. There comes a time when words fail. Hallelujah.